Good evening. In the news tonight, Israel's 93-year-old former president Shimon Peres was rushed to the hospital today. The cop who put Eric Garner in a deadly chokehold saw a spike in his pay. The Bronx defenders are waiting on whether or not a federal judge will dismiss their suit against New York Governor Cuomo over clogged courts in the Bronx. The move to include halal and kosher meals in New York City public schools is in focus, and the fifth anniversary of Occupy Wall Street is coming up. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Tuesday, September 13th, 2016. Shimon Peres, Israel's 93-year-old former president, was rushed to the hospital today after suffering a stroke. He has since been sedated and placed on a respirator. Doctors administered a CT scan but have not yet released the results. Israeli TV station says Peres is suffering bleeding in the brain and described the stroke as serious. Peres has held virtually every senior political office in Israel over a seven-decade career. This included three terms as prime minister. He won the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize for his role in the peace process with the Palestinians. The UN envoy for Syria is hailing a significant drop in violence, this over the first 24 hours of a new ceasefire which was brokered by the U.S. and Russia. Stefan de Mistura says no UN humanitarian aid trucks have yet moved across the Turkish border into Syria. He says UN officials are awaiting assurances that drivers of aid trucks will be unhindered and untouched. De Mistura says no letters of authorization from Syria's government are needed under the U.S. and Russian arrangement, only a simple notification to Damascus about the contents of the trucks that have yet been moved. He says aid for rebel-held eastern Aleppo is a top priority, that a key concern about the overall ceasefire is whether sporadic incidents snowball to threaten the deal. On the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton is recuperating from pneumonia. Donald Trump is in Iowa, championing himself as the president of everyone. The strategy is to capitalize on Clinton saying half of his Republican supporters belong in a basket of deplorables. President Obama is putting down Trump's idea that he is favored by working-class voters. He told thousands of supporters in Philadelphia today that the GOP presidential nominee wouldn't let you all on his golf course, and now suddenly this guy is going to be your champion. Close to home, attorneys are questioning potential jurors in the George Washington Bridge Lane closing trial in New Jersey. Several people already have been dismissed because defense attorneys or prosecutors or both contend they can't be impartial. Opening statements are soon. They are scheduled for September 19th in the trial of two former allies of Republican Governor Chris Christie. Bridget Kelly and Bill Baroni were indicted last year on charges they caused gridlock, this near the busy crossing in 2013 to punish a local mayor who didn't endorse Christie. The Bronx defenders have brought a federal case on the behalf of thousands of New Yorkers who are affected by systematic delays in the processing of misdemeanor cases in the Bronx. The case is called Trowbridge versus Cuomo. Scott Levy is attorney with the Impact Litigation Group at the Bronx Defenders.
The Bronx Defenders, along with Emery, Chelly, Brinkerhoff, and Abbey, and Morrison, Forrester, brought a suit on behalf of people who are charged with misdemeanors in the Bronx criminal courts, basically saying that people who are charged with misdemeanors in the Bronx criminal courts are unable to have their day in court because of endemic court delay. Our clients were forced to come back to court over and over and over again without any meaningful opportunity to have their day in court, and we are saying that this is a violation of due process and of the speedy trial right.
The defendants in the case filed a motion to dismiss, and now the Bronx defenders are waiting on the judge's decision.
Well, I think the best outcome would be for the federal court to say that there are constitutional violations taking place in the Bronx criminal court and to order a remedy to fix those constitutional violations.
Levy says first and foremost what is needed is an acknowledgement of the problems, the constitutional violations taking place, that a remedy would stem from that.
What we're saying is that there are sort of structural barriers to the speedy trial, in the Bronx, right? There are structural barriers that prevent people from having speedy trials and from having their day in court. And, you know, we want a remedy that addresses that.
And how bad is it, really, in the Bronx in terms of the courts? How long are people generally waiting?
People are waiting on average over close to 700 days for a bench trial and close to 900 days for a jury trial, and these are just misdemeanor cases. There are consistently more cases pending over a year in the Bronx than there are in all of the other boroughs combined. So there are lots of old cases that are clogging up the system, and the delays that people face who are trying to get trials are overwhelming, and essentially render the right to trial meaningless and illusory.
Scott Levy is with the Bronx Defenders. You can learn more about the case, about the clogged courts in the Bronx, by going to bronxdefenders.org. And at City Hall today, there has been new legislation introduced so inmates are not brought to court in jail uniforms. The City Council says wearing uniforms in court is unfair, that people are forced to testify in a Department of Corrections uniform just because they are too poor to afford bail. Another problem, they say, is that about 100 people a day are released from jail during court appearances, many of whom are pretrial detainees whose cases were dismissed, and then they are released onto the streets of New York in a thin piece of clothing, quite evidently a jail uniform, even in the wintertime. The City Council's legislation seeks to correct this problem. In other news, Politico and then the New York Daily News reported that the NYPD officer who put Eric Garner in a deadly chokehold in Staten Island back in 2014, Daniel Pantaleo, who has been on modified duty since then, had a $20,000 jump in his pay. Pantaleo earned $119,996 in fiscal year 2016. His base pay was $78,000, and he earned $23,000 in overtime, this according to a review of payroll records. He received an additional $12,853 in unspecified pay. This could include retroactive pay or even bonuses. Eric Garner's family is outraged. City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Vivedito said it was appalling that Pantaleo got such an overtime haul. In other news, a gazebo where Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old black boy holding a pellet gun, was fatally shot by Timothy Lohman, a white Cleveland police officer, is expected to be dismantled beginning this week. It will be shipped to a Chicago museum for display. An attorney said Tamir's mom wanted the gazebo to become a symbol for what happened to him. Tamir was killed by Lohman within 2 seconds of his cruiser skidding to a stop near him outside a recreation center where the gazebo was located. Two local companies will be handling removal of the structure, which was piled with stuffed animals and flowers after Tamir's death. His death was among those that fueled the National Black Lives Matter movement, along with those of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner here in New York City. Family attorney Chandra said Tamir's mom originally wanted the gazebo demolished, but she changed her mind as she came to understand its historic importance. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Here in New York City, public school students from Muslim and observant Jewish households are going hungry. Sylvia Lam is with SAFEST. It's the South Asian Fund for Education, Scholarship, and Training.
Right now, students, whenever they go to lunch, they don't have halal food. So they have limited options that are out there. Some people, they can't afford to have, like, you know, packed food every day, and it's really hard. And we would like if the schools would actually provide halal food, halal options, because our children are being malnourished, and they don't have that option out there, so we need to have halal food and kosher food.
Lam, along with students and elected officials, held a recent rally at City Hall. They brought attention to public school lunches, which leave some students hungry.
I've been a New York City public school student for my entire life, and I have 2 more years left in the system, and I'm also practicing Muslim.
Stuyvesant High School junior Tahsin Shaduri.
And I'm also practicing Muslim. That means that I have dietary restrictions, and I have to eat halal. And I've gone through my elementary, middle, and high school years struggling to sometimes find food in school that I could eat. You can only eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches over and over again for so long. And I know my peers from Bronx Science and MassPeth have gone through the same. And I think it's really important that the community and New York City recognize the importance of having NERS students within within the classroom and having students that are not going hungry.
New York City public advocate Tish James says for the changing demographic in the city, food offerings are very important for students who depend on school lunches but don't eat them.
There's no excuse for any child to go hungry in our schools in the city of New York. Instead of worrying about being hungry or when they might get their next meal, our children need to focus on their learning.
James says one third of the students in public schools were born outside the U.S. Over 13% identify as Muslim. Over 25% identify as Jewish. She says it's important to address this diverse population. She stands alongside Sudat Khan. He's a Stuyvesant High School freshman. He explains that Muslims are only allowed to eat halal food.
You all may be wondering, what does halal mean? So basically, halal is an Arabic word that translates to permissible or allowed in English. Therefore, halal food is permissible to be eaten by Muslims. For meat to be halal, the animal must be slaughtered by a Muslim who says a blessing, and the Muslim must be using a sharp knife with a swift cut through the throat. Not only that, but the animal cannot be treated with any antibiotics and growth hormones. So generally speaking, the animal is much more healthier and the animal goes through a much more humane lifestyle.
Making the case for halal in public schools, Khan says it's not only good for Muslims, but there's a cost benefit for New York City schools.
Generally speaking, halal meat is cheaper than regular meat. So this means that cafeterias can use the extra money that they create for something else productive, such as supporting schools for computers or extra technology that students can use. Not only that, but as I said before, halal meat tends to be healthier. This is because not only is the killing method different, they also drain the blood from the animal's body. And what this does is it eliminates any foodborne diseases through the blood. So therefore, I believe that New York City schools should provide halal food for not only Muslim students, but everyone in the community.
Syed Islam is a junior at Ness Plus M in Queens. He says he and others need to go out to food trucks outside of schools to get halal food. And when they can't or they don't have money, they go hungry.
If we do not add halal and kosher meals to our public schools, money will soon become a concern for low-income families, which makes up 42% of our New York City population. Also, when children do not have money in their wallets, they tend to not eat anything at all. I experience it firsthand, often when I did not have enough money to buy myself a halal meal. The effects of not eating my lunch struck me in my preceding classes, where I began to feel lightheaded and dizzy, ultimately causing a lack of focus. However, this issue not only pertains to student performance, but also equality in the lunchroom. If Muslim and Jewish students cannot eat their permitted foods, then 2 million students are being ignored. I strongly believe that adding kosher and halal meals in our cafeterias can only benefit, whether it be our performance as students or creating a comfortable environment for the future generations.
And for those who say there are no Jewish students in public schools affected by not having kosher meals, Councilmember Mark Levine, chair of the City Council's Jewish Caucus, says not true.
It's a myth that there are no kosher observant kids in the public schools anymore. There are thousands of kids from homes where they observe kosher dietary laws in the family, and then they get to school and they're faced with the terrible choice of either not eating or violating their faith. No child should be put into that role. You know, we are providing in our food bank system kosher meals. There's no reason we couldn't provide kosher and halal meals in our school system.
New York State Assembly members Mark Weprin and Pam Harris say they will work in the state legislature to enact changes. Assembly member Harris.
I represent a district that is the mecca of diversity. And what we heard today was some students who talked about leaving their safe net, which is their school, to go buy lunch. That right there alone is scary. We are taking children from their extension from home, which is their school, and we're placing them in harm's way. That right there alone is so important. Our children should not have to leave their school system, their safe net, to go buy something to eat. You know, there's a phrase that was coined so many years ago, food for thought. And if we use that and allow our children to take that coined phrase, food for thought, we would understand how safety, how much safest is so important to us. So I will, in our future session, I will make sure that I am on board with my colleagues and make sure that we champion a bill that is definitely going to make change to this.
Before becoming executive vice president in the school system, I was a cook for 17 years.
Donald Nesbitt is with DC 37.
I know firsthand what it's like when kids are hungry and they leave the lunchroom without eating. You see it in their face, you see it in their expression. They can't function and learn during the day. So we understand that it's pertinent for them to have nutritious, balanced meals. New York City public schools are a microcosm of the diversity that we have here in New York City. The schools are a reflection of our communities. If we acknowledge the Jewish and Muslim holidays, then it's only right that we acknowledge the nutritional needs of observant Jewish students as well as Muslim students. We need to invest in our students. No child should go home hungry or go to sleep without having a balanced meal.
That's right.
And if we do it for anything, we should do it because children are 20% of our entire population, but they are 100% of our future.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. In the days before the 15th anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks on 9/11, there were three attacks on Muslim women. Two of the attacks have been treated as hate crimes. The police are still investigating the latest. Rebecca Miles has more.
The most recent incident was when a traditionally dressed Muslim woman found her blouse set on fire by a man with a lighter in New York's Midtown. Police said the Scottish tourist said she felt heat on her arm on Saturday night as she was standing outside a Fifth Avenue luxury boutique in Manhattan and noticed her blouse was on fire. Namariq Alhine patted out the fire and noticed a man standing nearby holding a lighter. The man then walked away. The New York Police Department Hate Crime Task Force is investigating the attack as a possible bias crime. They've released a video of the man they suspect carried out the attack. It's not clear what police meant by traditional dress, whether she wore a hijab or a burqa. So far, there have been no arrests. The New York chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations released a statement to follow the incident, calling on city officials to address attacks against Muslims across the city and nationwide. The statement said, "We're clearly seeing a spike in attacks on individual Muslims and Islamic institutions in New York and around the country, which should be a concern to all Americans," said Nafia Nashir, CARES New York's executive director. "It's time for the mayor and the NYPD to put forward the necessary resources to investigate and prevent these attacks on the Muslim community." The incident makes it the third attack on Muslim women in New York just before the 15th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center on 9/11. In a separate attack last week, police said a New York City woman was arrested after she assaulted two Muslim women pushing their children in strollers in Brooklyn. The attacker reportedly punched one of the women and attempted to remove her hijab while shouting, "Get the F out of America." The woman has been charged by prosecutors with two counts of felony assault as a hate crime and two counts of acting in a manner injurious to a child. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
In other news, the fifth anniversary of Occupy is coming up this Saturday, and original occupiers are being called back to Zuccotti Park. Jan Weinberg is with the nonprofit Show Up America. He says with the anniversary falling on a Saturday, more people are expected to attend the anniversary than in years past.
We've sent out invitations to many of the people who were originally occupying the park physically, the different working groups that were established that still exist in New York City to attend, activists who moved on to different organizations. I sent out invitations to 400 social service organizations in New York City so they can come and tell their stories about how they've been inspired because of Occupy.
Throughout the day, as there was with Occupy, there will be general assemblies with working groups. Weinberg says alt media, the alternative media, is an important part of Occupy.
A great many of the alt media of representatives who are going to be there fully understand that they are part of the social movement, because mainstream media, because of government and corporate control, have redacted most of the true news. Or they touch on aspects of the news without digging in deeper. So our purpose is to have all media people and social justice activists tell each other their own stories. But the alt media are part of our social movement, because we have to push back and we have to get the information out. So social media is an aspect of it, Twitter and Facebook and those types of things. But the actual journalists and photojournalists and documentarians will be present on F-17.
And looking back on the genesis of the Occupy movement shows that it had its roots in the past.
Well, it's quite true that many people were thinking and acting on the same type of principles before Occupy came into effect. But the Occupy was inspired by a number of people before. So I'm certain Bernie Sanders had his ideas in place, but it certainly empowered him in running for president, even though he fell short of dealing with militarization issues, which would have propelled him even further. But there were many, many authors, Joseph Stiglitz, for example, who touched upon so many of the principles. Though in the Occupy working groups, there was direct democracy principles put in effect. So there was no leaders and no... Some of those things were honed and fashioned much better in terms of how to communicate in large-scale meetings. And the best of it is on the live calls that we have around the country. With the direct democracy principles.
And now, 5 years later, the Occupy movement has extended well past Zuccotti Park, according to Weinberg.
From my point of view, language could affect how we think, how we behave. And there's a number of the jargon, for example, that came out of Occupy. We are the 99%. Well, we had a politician recently that turned that into the cornerstone of his presidential campaign, about the 1% or the 1% of the 1%. So language can actually affect reality. And so having knowledge, being aware of how government corporate collusion could affect our lives is important for the conversation. And that does affect, and it can encourage politicians to behave better.
And Occupy had an effect on the way that people organized the Fight for 15, for example.
Yes, that was fascinating, because Fight for 15 brought in probably 20 to 30 coalition groups. It wasn't Fight for 15 just by themselves. For example, 2013, Black Friday, November 29th, Fight for 15 coordinated with many organizations across the country, and we had 1,500 simultaneous protests outside of Walmarts across the country. That got media attention because that was amazingly dramatic. So what we've learned to do, any of the organizations, is to form coalitions for any of the actions or education symposiums. So it's not standing alone, and we need to build on that more.
For more information on the fifth anniversary of Occupy, go to OccuEvolve, OccuEvolve on the web, or just show up this Saturday at Zuccotti Park. In other news, slavery and human trafficking are being used to drive already endangered plants and animals into extinction. They contribute to climate chaos, and the U.S. government is complicit in this. Ken Gale with WBAI's EcoLogic has tonight's commentary.
The palm oil industry says palm oil is a healthy alternative, but it's not. It increases bad cholesterol. You'll find it in literally thousands of products, including processed foods, cosmetics, and bath products. And even if palm oil was good for us, it doesn't justify making orangutans extinct in the wild. Nothing does. It doesn't justify enslaving men, women, and children. Nothing does. It doesn't justify burning tropical rainforests, which change global wind patterns and therefore global climate. This is happening in many parts of South America and throughout Asia, especially Southeast Asia, such as Malaysia. Malaysia has one of the worst records on human trafficking in the world. But last year, the U.S. State Department changed Malaysia's designation so they could sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership. which is probably the worst legislation ever proposed. It gives multinational corporations control over virtually every law that is supposed to be helping or protecting us, all to profit the 1%. But there are solutions. There is hope. The House and Senate have already passed a bill to ban imports made with convict labor, forced labor, or indentured labor. This eliminates the so-called consumptive demand exception that has been in place since 1930, which allows forced laborers into the country if they're in short demand in the U.S. It's waiting for President Obama's signature. But Europe and Japan are also markets for slave-made products. Our work isn't done. For commentary, I'm Ken Gale.
You can hear more on this topic this evening on EcoLogic right here on WBAI beginning at 8 p.m. Gale's guests include experts in international human trafficking, tropical deforestation, and the TPP. And finally, polls are open until 9 p.m. this evening. This as New Yorkers vote in the primary. During the April 19th presidential primary, the Attorney General's office received over 1,000 complaints about voter irregularities at the polls. The AG's office says it is investigating. They set up a hotline to troubleshoot and resolve voting problems today. Voters are urged to call 800-771-7755. That's 800-771-7755, or email civil.rights@ag.ny.gov if you're having any problems. The hotline is staffed by attorneys and staff in the office's Civil Rights Bureau this evening. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, September 13th, 2016. The news was produced with Rebecca Miles, Ken Gale, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.